From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Reverend Jesse Jackson and why he believes Donald Trump's election has set up a struggle for the soul of America.
The one who lit the fire must know you cannot govern under these conditions. You're going to create a nation that is vigorously divided and driven by incitement of fear rather than excitement of hope.
Michigan in the race to be a center for 21st century mobility.
We're competing with a California dreaming culture where they just put out a bold vision and talk about it as if it's real already.
Plus, early student life at Michigan State on a campus surrounded by swamps and forest.
The students would work half the day and they'd actually build the campus the other half. So there wasn't a town surrounding them, it was a swamp.
Those stories and much more, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The turmoil and division our nation has gone through for many long months has not eased since the election of Donald Trump. Today, civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, is in Ann Arbor, speaking in panels and speaking at a rally on the campus of the University of Michigan, sharing his thoughts on what's ahead for us under President Donald Trump. I had a chance to sit down with Reverend Jackson earlier today.
A week ago, we woke up to the news that Donald Trump is our president-elect. How would you describe where we are this day, a week later?
There are two issues that stand out in my mind. One is that Hillary Clinton had the most votes, he had the fewest votes. The one person, one vote democracy, she's the winner. In a democracy where the vote of the common people is diminished, and that a group of overseers determine the winner, it's a different outcome. So it raises the question, really, are a one-person, one-vote democracy or an aristocracy, which is a struggle for the soul of America. December 19th, when the electors vote, Hillary Clinton will have had 2 million plus more votes, and that's a big day in American history.
What has that led in this country when I think that, you know, since the election, across the country, we've seen a real burst of hate incidents. Here in Ann Arbor, a student at the University of Michigan reports she was threatened by a man who said, I'll light you on fire if you don't remove your hijab. What has this election opened up in this country?
There are two issues here. One issue is the count of the vote. Mm-hmm. Issue is the character of the campaign. The character of the campaign was to exacerbate fears rather than to create hope or to expand hope. The threat to Mexican Americans. I've talked with Mexican American children crying, fear their parents will be in the 15 million deported, for example. Ban on Muslims. We ran a campaign on that basis of chasing down the birthplace of President Barack Obama, saying that women who fight for right of self-determination, that if they want to have an abortion, it's back to states' rights again. They're going to challenge Roe v. Wade. These threats have created tremendous fear. So these student demonstrations and street demonstrations are born of fear. And the man who set the field afire has a responsibility to wipe it out.
But speaking of fear, as we heard very clearly, there are legions of voters who feel afraid for their futures. Their savings have been wiped out, their pay has been cut, jobs are gone, some of the, you know, their towns have been hit hard. And those, they say, are their primary concerns and why they voted for Mr. Trump. And they say they resent being called racist and misogynist and xenophobic. How do you respond to those
fears?
The
economic consternation is real. The scapegoating is wrong. Mm-hmm. That's why Bernie Sanders and Trump had the same appeal to that group of people. Guns in, drugs in, jobs out. We globalized capital without globalizing human rights and workers' rights. And so Trump looks through a keyhole and sees the dry field and lights a match. Bernie Sanders and Hillary look at that same field and put water to grow to make the grass green. So do you green that field or do you say it's a zero-sum game and set it on fire? And so people have been led to vote for Trump. You have to excuse the anti-feelings toward Muslims and African-Americans and Latinos and women. That's a lot to jump over just to vote.
You have seen so much in your lifetime as a civil rights activist and leader, going back to Jim Crow and marching alongside Martin Luther King. In what ways do you see what's happening right now post-election as a continuation of our long history of racism in America?
Well, there are two things happening. The first thing is that there is a great struggle over the integrity of the voting process, where the winner loses and the loser wins. That is a legitimate fight to make our democracy as it says it is on paper, all formed by the people, one person, one vote. On the other hand, that the some of the wounds created and some of the fears that came in the process of campaigning will not go away easily. I'm looking at children crying for fear and parents being deported, the Muslim children threatened, hijab snatched from their heads. That's just wrong. And the one who set the fire, Mr. Trump has the most obligation to put the fire out. And then you add to that fire the fuel of taking white nationalism to the highest level of our government. That's more fuel. That's not more water.
Looking at the numbers from the election, just in the city of Detroit, which is, of course, a majority African-American city, Hillary Clinton got nearly 50,000 fewer votes than President Obama did in 2012, and turnout was lower as well. What do you think did the Clinton campaign miss or not do enough of to be attractive to more black voters?
Well, first of all, the most voters she got were black, point one. Point two, President Barack was an extraordinary candidate, a historical candidate with charisma and substance. We did not lose Michigan because of Detroit. There are all the workers whose jobs had gone abroad got bailed out by the Democrats that ignored their deliverance. 8 years ago, we lost 800,000 jobs in 1 month. All the industry was virtually gone. Now it's back again. And many people did not vote their interests. In the same time, in the city of Detroit, 100,000 vacant homes and abandoned lots. If you just remove the lead paint jobs, if you cut the grass and the weeds, landscapers' jobs, if you demolish the houses that cannot stand, jobs, if you put windows for the boards, jobs. So there appears to be no urban plan for reconstruction. Many people who had hope 7 years ago don't have the same hope today. They may not vote the same way today they voted 8 years ago.
What do you think the Democratic Party needs to do now?
To fight for the suppressed vote. If the suppressed vote had counted, it would be a different discussion today. Even though the federal government intervened in North Carolina to stop what they call surgical precision of voter discrimination, the North Carolina Republican leader brags about driving the black vote down 8.5 and the white vote up 22% by removing 400 precincts, by removing votes from campuses, for example. So if Democrats fight vigorously for the suppressed black vote, that's the key to victory. It's the margin by which Kennedy won in 1960. It's the margin by which Clinton won in 92 and 96. So the suppressed black vote is one outcome, the freed black vote is another.
When you think of what we've seen through the campaign and now since the election, the kinds of things I refer to, the hate signs left at churches and threatening words and gestures to racial and religious minorities, how do you think we keep this from becoming the new normal in America?
Well, the one who lit the fire must know you cannot govern under these conditions. You're going to create a nation that is vigorously divided and driven by the incitement of fear rather than the excitement of hope. I would only hope that Mr. Trump will govern differently than the campaign.
In the way we talk to each other as Americans, you look at social media, you look at comments following news stories.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
You raised a question about the people who voted for Trump are not being called racist. When you look at a candidate who espouses quote-unquote Jewish money and banned the Muslims, and a wall with Mexicans. If you look at all that racism and vote in spite of that, you're on that team. You're on the racist team. And you cannot somehow expect to be excused for that relationship.
Fair point. So I want to talk about how we talk with each other in this now divided country. And it's very clear. You see comments on social media saying, I don't want to hear, I don't want to know why you voted for, fill in the blank. What can concerned people do, citizens, to help our nation heal, whether they voted for Clinton?
Don't use the economic crisis as an excuse for racist behavior. Or don't call racism conservatism. The idea of racial fears and racial sanctuaries is not good for the human being. We've survived apart. We must learn to live together as brothers and sisters in love. When Michigan plays the big game on Saturday afternoon, it's uniform color, not skin color. It's direction, not complexion. If we can accept each other to fulfill our emotions and our joys as gladiators on the football field, we must see them as human beings on Monday morning in class and on the job. We've learned to play ball together. We've learned to fight wars together. We've not learned to live together. We must consciously work on learning to love and to live and to share.
When you think of the young people all around us on this campus, young people you'll be speaking with, they're the ones who are going to pick up the torch. What do you see as their greatest challenge?
There's a big rally today on this campus and 70 others around the country. I'm speaking at the rally here today because in this university space, who's their classmate, their roommate, their hallmate, maybe of different religions, they must affirm ecumenical, multi-religious, affirm multicultural living and learn it. They may have come from isolated spaces. They must learn on this campus to live in a civilized, humane way. They must learn to see the world through a door, not through a keyhole. They must learn that lesson and build a sense of internal strength and character.
What are your biggest fears for this generation as they go forth?
The biggest fear is that we would go backwards into fear rather than forward into hope. That we go backwards into polarization rather than forward into unity. We've made an awful lot of progress in 50 years. That progress is now threatened by this environment. I've seen football coaches take one position and their players another. I mean, at that level. I saw Coach Popovich from the San Antonio Spurs make a strong case last week for how uncivilized it is to teach children not to violate people based on race and religion, and how we voted for that. To that extent, it's a kind of shameful day for the country. There's no guarantee we're going to build up economically, but the evidence is we're worse off socially today and morally.
And finally, as you go around the country and especially meeting young people like you are on the campus, what are your hopes for this new generation as they prepare to take over?
That we'll become more active participants in our own political process, that we'll become less violent and more caring. With all of the achievements academically, people want to care that you know I'm at the University of Michigan, but they want to know that you care. I'm a human being, and that matters.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Archaeology isn't just about digging into prehistory and coming up with arrowheads, pottery shards, and mastodon bones. It can also give us a window into the not-too-distant past, say, the campus of Michigan State University, around 1860. That's what Autumn Beyer is doing in her work with the MSU Campus Archaeology Program. She's studying what students and professors ate in the early days of Michigan State and how they got that food. Autumn Beyer is a second-year PhD student in archaeology and with us now. Welcome, Autumn.
Good to be here.
Now, these days, if a college student wants a quick bite or a midnight snack outside the campus dining halls, we can swing over to Chipotle or Five Guys. So take us back to Michigan State's early period, 1855 to 1870. What options did hungry students have?
It was very limited. Back in this period, all the students lived on campus, and most of the faculty did as well. And that's because that's just when the campus was being formed. So the students would work half the day and they'd actually build the campus the other half. So there wasn't a town surrounding them. It was a swamp. So if they wanted other food, they would have to travel to Lansing, which was a really difficult thing to do because there wasn't an actual road. So for getting extra food or things like that, they'd end up going picking berries or go fishing in the river or even going hunting for turkey or deer.
I suspect, you know, people may have come from farms or may have, not everybody came from cities, so people were used to going out and snagging a wild turkey.
Yes, definitely. There was a story of two students who actually went hunting for a turkey and they ended up getting it and they brought it to one of the professor's houses and they found out that this other professor was actually trying to hunt this same turkey that day. So they all shared it for dinner, so it turned out good in the end that everybody got some turkey. It wasn't just the students who were, in a sense, foraging or hunting on campus.
When we think of that early period, Autumn, 1855 to 1870, what kind of things were people eating when they sat down at the dinner table?
we've been doing a lot of research into this, not just through the archaeological remains, the animal bones that we found in the privy or like the toilet that was associated with one of the first dormitories on campus, Saints Rest, but we've also been going to the archives on MSU's campus and looking through the purchasing records, and we're able to see the different types of food that they've been buying. So things like steak and mutton, salted pork, salted beef, a lot of crackers, which is interesting. But they've also had some really interesting imported foods as well, which I was very surprised to see, like Lake Superior whitefish and halibut.
And I'm wondering why it's important in 2016 to uncover and understand MSU's hunting and gathering past.
Well, it's part of MSU's history. As technically an MSU alum, I did my undergrad here and graduated in 2013, and now I'm back for my PhD. I love hearing about MSU's history and MSU's past, and just knowing more about the area in Michigan in general of what was going on, to me, is fascinating. And understanding how they were getting these different resources in this very isolated area that was campus at the time.
When you think of the campus of the time, you're saying basically it's, what was it, swamp and woodlands that surrounded it?
Yep. It was mostly swampy. That's why MSU built their campus there. Nobody else, I think, really wanted the land, and it was open to take. So these students were actually filling in the landscape and building the buildings, some of them that are, there's some still on campus, like building their dormitories, the faculty houses, the different classroom buildings, things like that. They were building all of these things that they were actually then using as students.
Autumn Beyer is a PhD student. She's an archaeologist, and she is with Michigan State University digging into the hunting and gathering past at Michigan State. Great talking with you about your work, Autumn. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing now with our series, Minding Michigan, as we focus on mental health questions in our state. It's a real challenge to talk about mental health issues and challenges, and even more so when you're young, when you feel like an other. Marcel Price is tackling that challenge through poetry and spoken word. As Fable the Poet, this young Michigander writes about mental wellness. And in his work with Mental Health America, he travels to high schools around Michigan and across the country, helping kids understand their shared struggles. His new chapbook of poetry is called Adrift in a Sea of M&Ms. Marcel Price, Fable the Poet, welcome. And I want to talk about your performance name. How does Fable reflect the message you're trying to spread with your poetry and performances?
Traditional fables are stories that you learn from, where animals normally take place of humans. And when I was first writing, I really wanted to take myself out of my work. I was going through a lot of issues with domestic violence and like substance abuse at home. And it was actually a high school English teacher that really encouraged me to write. And at that point, I was writing more or less traditional fables in work where I didn't really want to talk about myself and what was going on at home. So I used fables to do so.
In what ways is poetry a good way to express what's in your heart and to really put out the messages that you want to get out there?
From a performance standpoint, it's just a huge release. There's a lot of things that you want to let off your chest that at times you don't always get the opportunity to do so. And you can just vent. You can let it all off of your chest. You can just shout it out to the masses. And it feels good to yell. And it feels good to say these things that sometimes have been pent up for so long. And from a reader's standpoint, there's a lot of people who are going through things, have gone through things in their past or present, and they don't have a way to talk about it. So sometimes it's cathartic to read it and take it in if you've also shared these experiences, which is like one of the main reasons that I wanted to bring these collections of poems to life, just because I know there are so many people that are going through these issues. And I feel like that's why I love poetry and what it does for me.
It sounds incredibly cathartic, really cathartic. And you really spend a lot of time writing about the intersection of mental wellness and people of color, and that's born out of your own life. Tell us more about that.
At age 14, I was diagnosed with anxiety, bipolar, and depression. And I was growing up in a home that was rooted in different kinds of abuse, as well as a stepfather who had a problem with alcoholism and drugs. When you're growing up a young person of color, at least for me, growing up biracial in school, I was always too light or too dark for certain crowds. And there's this like strange intersection. But growing up as a person of color, you're not you're not told to talk about your issues with mental health. You're battling systematic racism. You're constantly being shown all these these images in the media now with police brutality and all these other things. And there's so many things you have to stay aware and focus on that at times you stop focusing on yourself and your own wellness, especially mental wellness, which is so important, because if you're not mentally stable, then how are you expected to shoulder and put everything else on your shoulders and keep on pushing through everything?
What is it you want to explore at that intersection of mental health and race? Take us into that.
I tend to find, at least through a lot of organizations that I worked with and through really digging through and learning about mental wellness, that there's kind of a certain face or a stigma on mental health. It's whenever you look up resources for mental wellness, you always tend to see these same select few faces. And it's almost people of color don't go through these issues. And what I really want to explore is I want young people of color or even older people of color to just feel comfortable vocalizing that they're going through things and not feel that they just have to be these strong individuals that the media portrays them to be, or that they feel that they have to be all the time. It's okay to be vulnerable sometimes, and it's okay to reach out to people, and it's okay to say that, hey, I'm going through things personally. As a human being, I'm suffering through a lot. I'm dealing with all of these things on my plate, and I'm also dealing with all these outside factors.
I noticed you're using that term, mental wellness, not mental health, not mental illness. What is the importance of choosing to use mental wellness?
The reason that I always say mental wellness is because an illness makes it seem like it's a problem, it's an issue that needs to be solved. When I've met so many individuals who are autistic, who are depressed, who have bipolar disorder, that are brilliant, shining individuals. And a lot of me thinks that when it comes to things like ADHD, at one point it wasn't frowned upon to be a quick thinker. It wasn't frowned upon to have your mind be in multiple places at once. That's a positive. And I feel like if you can hone that, and if you can find a way to make it work the best for you, and as long as you're happy and as long as you're comfortable being you, if your mind is in 100 different places at once, that's a brilliant thing.
There's no one way to be.
Right. There's no one way to be. And that's what a lot of this book is about, is it's about combating what people know is normal, or what society deems is normal, because normality is played out. Who wants it? Who's ever been told that you're exceptionally normal, and people took it as oh, that's a great compliment. Thanks. That's what I've been striving to be.
I'm speaking with Marcel Fable, the poet Price, whose new chapbook of poems is Adrift in a Sea of M&Ms. Would you read us the first poem, and its intro, as it's called, and you admonish your reader, keep this in mind after reading each poem.
Ever since we saw a poor Aladdin caress cold brass, creating riches, a Robin Williams voice genie animated with a smile that will last longer than the memory of him being seen as genuinely happy, everyone has always wanted that one wish. I wish I could get through this. Trust me, you can. I wish suicide didn't seem so appealing. Remember, a robin flew to the heavens. Please make other plans. Keep fighting through. I wish this didn't happen to me, yet here you stand, stronger. Weathered, whether you know it or not, others have experienced this process. You are the driftwood crafted from a hurricane of experiences, no one the same. Bask in that for a while. You are an example to others, a masterpiece that proved worthy of display. Those skeletons hanging, bring them out of the closet, accessorize them with new J's, some fresh shell toes, heels, or flats. Hell, put them in a picture frame. Do not bother with a do not touch sign. Let the oils of people's fingertips leave imprints just as unique as you. Leave the ripples on your open wounds. I know crimson stains, same as fresh paint, but don't be ashamed of the scars. One day they will heal. You just need to live to tell the story. Promise me you will live to tell the story, that you will encourage others to do the same. Your story needs to be heard. Believe this. I know when drowning, breathing is hard, or even wanting to, But promise me you'll be the robin once spiraling to the ground that chose to give flying another try. Wishes are like prayers, fueled by faith. I believe in you.
Marcel Fable, the Poet Price. Okay, that is powerful. And with that, I know I'm thinking of the fact that you and other members of the Artist Collective, the Diatribe, are doing interactive assembly programs around race and mental health in schools all over Michigan.
Yeah.
What kind of looks do you get from, what do you see in the faces of young people when you read that, when you say that message?
I just, so many of them just look just like baffled and confused yet relieved. In so many of the assemblies that we do, that ends in a lot of individuals in tears and hugging. It ends in a lot of people in the audience like looking at each other like, wow, I didn't know everybody was going through this. And it opens up people's mind to the fact that like everybody's told that everybody is going through something. But when you make it a point to bring that to life in an assembly, it really opens the youth's mind to wait. So-and-so was on my nerves and I might have said something mean to them in the hallway, or I feel like so-and-so is picking on me, but they're going through the exact same thing that I am. And in some schools like Riverview East, which is a little bit closer to Canada, we've had youth start up their own collectives of writers and actually start up their own poetry clubs and get together with individuals who they knew nothing about and listen to each other's stories and pick each other up. And it's incredible to be, I don't know, the planter of those seeds.
That is something. And I know you've chosen to become involved in Mental Health America. What kind of new platform did that give you?
That was such a humbling, incredible opportunity. So I went on a poetry tour close to 2 years ago. It was 10 states, 12 weeks, 35 shows, starting in New Orleans, ending in New York. And Mental Health America had me sit on their panel for the importance of like youth advocacy work with mental health, as well as be one of their keynote speakers at their annual conference. And there was all these mental health professionals. I mean, it's predominantly a lot of people who don't look like me. So to have all these individuals sit and listen and then also come up to me and validate my feelings and just say, wow, we never thought to do things like that. It was incredible. And I felt so privileged to help so many individuals who have done this for so long and who studied and know so much about this start thinking outside of the box. But they've sent me to multiple different high schools across the country. In May, I'll be going back to New York to work with Mental Health America of Dutchess County in Poughkeepsie, as well as like Mental Health America of Greater Indianapolis has brought me out quite a few times. But I don't know, it's always just so beautiful because so many of these kids are battling these issues. So many of these kids have been diagnosed as depressed or bipolar or anxious, and so many of them feel displaced having this label stuck to them, which is why I like to call it mental wellness, mm-hmm. because so many of these individuals are still bright and flourishing, and just because of a diagnosis, it's not going to, I don't want it to cripple them or make them feel like they have any less of a reason to succeed and be them.
What do you say to the parents, to the family members of that young person who's grappling with depression or anxiety? What's the best way they can come and help?
Just being supportive. A lot of people think that being supportive means like talking to individuals in a different tone of voice, like they need to slow things down, like they need to walk on eggshells. And when you feel that somebody is walking on eggshells around you, or when you feel that somebody is like going above and beyond to cater to you, it almost makes you feel like a victim, or it makes you feel like, oh wow, this person is sad for me. And growing up, my mom is such an incredible woman and a staple in my life. But there's so many times where she's like, oh, I know you're doing that because the bipolar. And it's like, it's defeating to hear things like that.
So don't put me up on a shelf like a little China doll.
Exactly. 100%. Don't put me on a shelf like a China doll. I'm a human. Like, just help me believe and help me understand that I can get through this, and don't keep bringing it up because it's always on this person's mind already. So they don't need a reminder that they're going through it.
The book is Adrift in a Sea of M&Ms. Before I let you go, tell me about that title.
Adrift in a Sea of M&Ms. It all stems from a logo, and it stems from the cover of the book, which was done by Steve Weatherby or Crossworm. But everybody is going through something. Everybody feels fragile. Everybody feels like a paper boat being tossed across life's waves. But the M&M stands for mental disorders and mixed race issues. Those are what the M stand for. So it's being lost in all of these things. This book is for anybody who's been battling mental wellness issues. This is for anybody who is a person of color who's been told that they are too dark or too light or not right, that they need to stop acting white, or that they've been told that they're the whitest person that they know that's had their color attacked. This is for anybody who just wants to find themselves in a book and wants to understand that they're not alone.
Well, I know you've got a book release on the 30th in Grand Rapids at the Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters at Wealthy and Eastern. And then you're going to be busy on December 1st. You will be at University of Michigan Dearborn. And you can find out more details, find out more about the book and where Marcel Price will be appearing by just looking him up on Facebook. Look for Fable the Poet and you'll find him. Marcel, it was a great pleasure to meet you. And thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you very, very much.
Still to come, how the Motor City is working to become the Mobility City.
The critical mass of capability is anchored here in Southeast Michigan.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The push is on to get Detroit and Southeast Michigan at the forefront of the mobility movement, to reshape the Motor City into the Mobility City, a center for innovation in 21st century transportation and mobility. Here with us is Jean Redfield. She's the president and CEO of Next Energy, and Glenn Stevens, executive director of Mich Auto and the vice president of Automotive and Mobility Initiatives. Let's start right at the ground floor. What does that term mobility city mean to you, Jean?
For me, mobility city is the city of the future where the mobility needs, how do I get from point A to point B, are met for everybody with the timeliness, the convenience, the consumer experience, and the cost that the user expects.
And your take, Glenn?
Well, mobility city to me means it's not just how cars move or how people move. It's how goods and services and data flows freely and efficiently. And that's really what mobility encompasses.
And that's something that we want to see in Detroit. We want to see in Michigan and be a national leader.
We do, because there's a tremendous economic impact from it, but really there's primarily a safety reason for it. And as we connect things and the world becomes more connected, there's an opportunity to make the world safer. 1 million people lost their lives on global world roads last year. 960 some on Michigan roads last year, and we're up 40% this year. So using technology to make things safer and moving data, goods, and services more safe is important. But that economic impact to be part of this IoT auto-connected world is really, really a significant opportunity for us.
Gene, we know there are a lot of cities that are really in the hunt to become the leader in autonomous vehicles, the leader in transportation innovation. We've seen Pittsburgh's teamed up with Uber and has driverless cars on their streets as we speak. Silicon Valley's got a lot of the technology, talent, and the culture. Where is Detroit fitting into this race, do you think?
Well, I think Detroit has some things really going for it. First of all, as Glenn mentioned, the critical mass of capability is anchored here in Southeast Michigan. What we know about cars, what we know about connected technologies, and what we know about safety positions us uniquely compared to places like Pittsburgh and Silicon Valley. Where we're a little bit of a Johnny come lately, but making great strides in a short amount of time, is really getting together as a region around transportation and mobility issues so we can actually get deployments, not just development, going on here. And I think you'll be hearing some things over the next weeks and months about how those things are starting to take off in the city of Detroit and in the region as a whole.
Yeah, I would echo. Gene and I and our organizations work very closely together with other partners around the state. We formed the Michigan Mobility Initiative almost 2 years ago, and we have been actively working to position the state promote the state as a center for that, but also make sure we have policy and talent for the industry as we move forward. So we do have the greatest automotive cluster, and there's more automotive and connected vehicle research being done here anywhere in the world. But we have to leverage all that for our future and build that.
And I think it's important to note that it's not just research. There are real world things going on where things are taking the street. The two cohorts of Techstars mobility companies and what they're doing around mobility as a service initiatives, as well as other mobility businesses, and how they're anchored and growing in Michigan is one sort of proof point. The other thing, we've got a couple things going on at Next Energy that are mobility as a service type pilots. We have one where it's electric vehicles and college students working car share issues and really trying to understand what's the consumer experience and what are the implications for how the car is designed. And then we have one around e-scooters, electrified scooters, 30-mile range, 30 miles an hour, car share or vehicle share type model. Who cares? How does that work in a city like Detroit? How do people expect to use them? What are the implications then for both the consumer interface and also the vehicle itself in terms of how battery life and some of the other design issues associated with e-scooters. So we do have mobility pilots active in the city.
Absolutely.
They're a little below the radar compared to the big splashy Uber announcements in places like Pittsburgh.
But it's bubbling away.
Yeah, and one of the things we suffer from a little bit in the Midwest is we are an engineering culture where we design it, we build it, we make sure it works before we pick our head up and say anything. And we're competing with a California dreaming culture where they just put out a bold vision and talk about it as if it's real already. And at some point,
Midwestern modesty.
Midwestern modesty, stick to our knitting and get the real work done around manufacturing, around safety, around trials, and then talk about what's possible and how we're ready to move.
Glenn, what do we need in infrastructure investment, especially in the Detroit area in Southeast Michigan?
Well, and it's an interesting time because of the election and the conversation that's happening about potential commitment, significant commitment to infrastructure, and our nation needs that. We're woefully inadequate. And as we invest in infrastructure, there's an opportunity to make it connected infrastructure. And that's what we need to do. So I give Kirk Steudel and the Michigan Department of Transportation an incredible amount of credit for being visionary in that. But we need the research projects, so we need to put the infrastructure projects in place, like the American Center for Mobility, like M-City, like Kettering University's General Motors Research Center. But as we expand and as we redo and repave and put new roads and systems in, we have to make sure that it's communicating with the transportation and the goods and the services that are free-flowing, like I talked about with mobility.
And I think there's one more thing to think about with infrastructure. And I think we're starting to get the policy leaders and the industry partners thinking that way, which is the idea of there's a future of infrastructure that's not each of the silos where roads are transportation infrastructure and the grid is the energy infrastructure and the telecoms is the data infrastructure. The reality is all three of those major infrastructure elements are starting to converge. Our energy networks, our data networks, and our physical land use networks around parking and transit and roads are converging. How do we think about that? How do we invest in that? And how do we make sure that those infrastructure elements get built so we can support these mobility solutions going forward? And the new building energy management and energy efficiency solutions going forward? And the distributed renewables and clean energy options going forward? We're building our 21st century cities, and we need to be using 21st century technologies to do so.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the push to make Michigan and Southeast Michigan in particular right up front in the race to become the leading mobility city in the nation. Talking with Gene Redfield, who's president and CEO of Next Energy, and Glenn Stevens, who's executive director of Mich Auto and the VP of Automotive and Mobility Initiatives. Glenn, have you seen any early returns on your efforts to attract talent to the Detroit area?
We have. And because we've been working on a very concerted effort and in a collaborative, that's the neat thing that we've seen over the last few years, driven by leadership in the state with the governor, the mayor, other executive leaders, you know, really people coming together to get on the same page as opposed to operating in silos or in conflict. So we're starting to see dividends with companies say, you know, it's not just automotive that's happening in Michigan, but these next generation mobility solutions are being driven and led here. And we're starting to see companies like Uber, like Google with their FCA arrangement. I was at Harman Automotive the other day, 1,000 engineers in a building in Farmington Hills in their new tech center. Incredible. And obviously Samsung has just made an acquisition move towards them. So this automotive tech convergence is happening. And now what we're seeing is not only do we design and build and integrate vehicles of today, but there's a recognition that we have the technology to do it for the connected vehicle and build the connected vehicle here too. So the focus is shifting here pretty dramatically. And I think that's a result of the work that we're collectively doing.
And is the talent coming?
So the talent is really multifaceted. We don't look at talent one-dimensionally. We have to look at how do we convince and how do we attract our youth to get more interested in the STEM focus or STEAM focus, and how do we grow our talent? Because we really have to grow it. That's the best pipeline we can do. So there's a steady stream and need for mechanical and electrical engineers, but above and beyond that now is this incredible thirst for software and systems and control engineers. So we have to do that. We have to attract people to come here. We have to utilize new Americans. So immigration issues and immigration reform are key. Veterans, my understanding is there are upwards of 300,000 veterans that come back into the workforce every year in this country. So we as a state, and we are doing this, have to look at holistically about how we attract and develop talent for today's industry and tomorrow's industry.
Let's look at putting the pieces together. And you mentioned University of Michigan has its M-City test site up and running, and we've been following the development of the American Center for Mobility, the $80 million driverless car test site that's being built at Willow Run. Flint, we've got Kettering University and GM building their mobility research center. Are these all complementing each other, or are we seeing any duplication of efforts in these?
Oh, I think the biggest thing that the region's got going on is the fact that we have the complementarity, that we have the capability to research, design, test, and deploy all in the same region. I mean, I would put even Next Energy Center into that mix. The work that we do around connected technologies with our DSRC testbed, USDOT certified testbed for connected vehicles, as well as electrification of vehicles, is definitely on the forefront of what's done all around the world. And so, you know, between the university research and talent, the early test tracks and development centers, and then cooperation for deployments around the region, I think Southeast Michigan is really poised to be that mobility capital.
And I definitely would say we're complementing because we're communicating. We use the Michigan Mobility Initiative, and we meet regularly, and we talk and communicate that way. But, you know, around the state, I was in Grand Rapids last week talking to them about Planet M and what we're doing with mobility solutions for Michigan. I was in Michigan Tech a couple months ago because they're doing incredible research up there because they have the snow facility to do connected vehicle. And as they put it up there, and I'm from the UP for Marquette, they put it up there, our weather is reliably crappy. And it's true because that when the snow sets in, the snow sets in. But to be able to do vehicle testing in that environment is extremely important.
Looking at the whole state, a hit and a miss, I think, in a sense. We saw the legislature move very quickly with a lot of bipartisan harmony to pass those bills allowing driverless vehicles on Michigan roads. Governor Snyder signed them into law. Senator Ken Horn of Franklin quoted as saying, this is the equivalent of the race to space.
Mm-hmm.
You're agreeing?
Absolutely. I think the idea of connected technologies and how they change our world is the space race of the 21st century. The challenge is it's not a single-minded focus. You know, the space race was land on the moon. The connected technologies future is a whole ecosystem of new technologies, new business models, and new players coming in and working with established players in new and different ways. So it's as aggressive as the space race and even harder to go after because it's not the single-minded focus but a whole ecosystem of capabilities and capacity that has to come together. And I think Michigan's getting its act together on that idea of the ecosystem and the collaboration and cooperation that requires.
And getting those public acts was a big important piece.
Incredible amount of bipartisan coalition that came together. I give Senator Cole a tremendous amount of credit because he's been a leader out on the front of this, and obviously Senator Horn, the governor. But we got it to where it needed to be to make sure that we stay in a place where effective, safe, controlled, And aggressive and progressive testing and research is enabled here in Michigan for companies to be here to do it. The companies that are here or the companies that want to come here to be part of this cluster of innovation.
Let's talk about a couple that things that look like setbacks. First of all, Detroit losing out on a number of competitive grants to improve transportation in the region. How bad a hit is that? And what do you see as how big an obstacle is that for our region, Gene?
I think it was definitely a disappointment because having those federal funds as seed for additional private leverage is always helpful. It's a reason for folks to come together and put their money where their mouth is to get things moving further faster. But I think Detroit is well positioned. I think we've had a pretty aggressive leadership acting in a very forward-leaning manner to get noticed by the USDOT and other federal agencies, and to actually put forward really compelling and aggressive plans that Detroit is probably best positioned to run with.
Well, it's a setback, but we also have to be realistic about where we just came from, and that's a city that was in bankruptcy and turmoil. So when the mayor took office, and he's put an incredible team in place, they have been focused on basic city services and getting those established in place, the lights back on, ambulances showing up on time. I mean, that's first. So now we're at a point where he's starting to, you know, talk about his vision for what Detroit looks like into the future, and things are happening in that space. So really, you know, always with a setback, you have to look at what's the opportunity for movement forward. And we see a lot of coalition work being done for us to collectively say, hey, I'm working in this space and you're working in this space. Why don't we work on these mobility solutions together? So we see it as opportunity. And the DOT and the White House Task Force has been extremely helpful to the city in helping us move forward.
What is the failure of the Regional Transit Authority millage proposal? What does that mean for Detroit's efforts or Southeast Michigan's efforts to become a mobility leader?
Well, that was a disappointment. We collectively put a lot of effort into that, and really to have that capability as the backbone for mobility is really something we desperately needed, and we still need. So we're going to reset and move forward, and again, you know, learn from what we learned and take it not as a setback, but how do we do this better for the future? How do we communicate it regionally? And so it was a setback at the time, but having that backbone of regional transit to be able to add on or bolt on or integrate with mobility as a service is absolutely essential for mothers to be able to get to the hospital for health care, for students to be able to get to school, and for people to be able to get to work.
In other words, voters, we're going to see you in 2 years and try again.
We have to try again. We've got to put these solutions in place.
Why should we be optimistic about mobility in Detroit, in Southeast Michigan, and really for the state of Michigan, Gene?
Well, I think the main reason for optimism about mobility in Detroit and Southeast Michigan is because of the capacity we have here, the talent, the assets, the companies that are already here, and the vision that the public and private sector leaders have put out in front for ourselves, for our region, but also as suppliers of mobility solutions for the planet. I mean, we have some of the largest OEMs on the planet shifting from automotive to mobility. And what that means for them in terms of business model, in terms of product design, in terms of new product service offerings, not just in Detroit, but in London, in Mumbai, in Shanghai. They get that, and they're moving aggressively forward with that. And I think that partnership of those global solutions anchored in Southeast Michigan is really compelling.
Glenn Stevens, you get the last word.
Well, I think we should be optimistic because of our DNA and our culture and our history. I mean, we put the world on wheels. So why not put the world into an autonomous vehicle and develop it, research it here, design and engineer it and build it here? And I think that's what we're going to do. We've got great blueprints in place. Business leaders from Michigan had the foresight to put Global Center for Mobility in their turnaround plan. The governor's leading. We've got private companies doing this. And I think we've got the coalitions and the people that want to work together to build this future for us. And again, it's important because technology can help save lives and because the economic impact of what this can mean for our state. It's not a question of whether we need to do it. It's a question of us doing it and making it happen because our future depends on it.
Glenn Stevens is the Executive Director of Mich Auto and Vice President, Automotive and Mobility Initiatives, and Gene Redfield, President and CEO, Next Energy. Pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings, and our engineer is Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Ryan Grimes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.